Hello and welcome to A House with a Past with me, Dr. Bruce Sturey. I'll be hearing your house histories and offering advice from experts. Today, we're looking at previous uses of properties, manses, schools and the like. And coming up, the lady who loved her holidays so much she bought the hotel, or at least a part of it.
We promised them lunch in the hotel, and having climbed up from the beach, we found when we got here there was no more hotel, but there was a developer creating six houses and one flat. So the family story now goes that instead of buying lunch, we bought a house.
More later. And there are pictures of all the homes coming up in today's programme available on our webpage, bbc.co.uk/Radio Scotland, and go to A House with a Past. But first today, a house that played a small part in one of the most intriguing literary stories of the 18th century. Eddie Stiven lives in Balcraggy, a former Church of Scotland manse in Glen Elg in the West Highlands. I recently visited this substantial 1830s property in the Glen of the Roe Deer to share a wee Diochen Doris with Eddie and hear a story about the manse's literary associations.
Well, the house, it was built, we believe, around about 1830, and on either side of the house there are wings, and it sits in a lovely big garden which is surrounded by the old glebe, the farm, if you like, of the ministers who lived in the manse until it was given up by the church in, I think, the 1960s.
Tell me, Eddie, this wasn't the first manse on this site, am I correct?
As far as I know, there was a manse built in the 18th century outside where our front door is, and you can still see the remains of it. There's a wall you can see in front of you as you open our front door. It's about 10 yards away. And that, I believe, was the outside long wall of the previous Jacobean manse. And that house was built, well, I don't know the date, but my guess is that it was built in the early 18th century.
Now, you mentioned earlier there's a connection between Balcraggy, the manse, and James McPherson, who was responsible for Ossian. What can you tell me about that?
James McPherson was a schoolmaster from King Uce. He was a Gaelic speaker, and he had an interest in the oral tradition. And he travelled round the Highlands, and he gathered material from the oral tradition, and he eventually put it all together in a publication which was called Fingal, the Tales of Ossian. And he wrote this in a very overblown style. And when this book came out, it had immediate acclaim. It was acclaimed not only in Britain, in Scotland and in England, where it was regarded as the equivalent of classical mythology, but based in the Highlands and Islands, based in the Gaelic culture. It was also acclaimed in Europe. It was much admired by Goethe. It was one of Napoleon's favourite books. Napoleon went on his campaigns with a copy of it. He used to sleep with a copy of Fingal underneath his pillow because he found it so inspiring. But shortly after publication and all this acclaim that came afterwards, it was similarly denounced by Dr. Samuel Johnson, who said that it was all invention, that McPherson hadn't used any oral tradition, he had made it all up. And that's the view that's generally taken on McPherson's work to this day.
So where does this house, Eddie, Balcraggy, come into that story of James McPherson?
The reason that the house comes into it, well, it wouldn't have been called Balcraggy then, because that's a modern 20th century name that's been given to it. It would just have been called the manse. The reason that that comes into it is that this is one of the places that was visited by James McPherson when he was collecting his oral traditional material. And we know this from a letter that came from the minister in 1764, the Reverend Donald MacLeod, who attests to his visit, and he also attests to the authenticity of the material which McPherson had used in the book. And it's addressed to the Committee of the Highland Society of Scotland, to a Dr. Blair. Sir, sometime before I was favoured with yours of November last, with regard to the authenticity of Ossian's poems, I had a letter from Mr. Alexander Macaulay, the Highland chaplain, upon the same subject. I then, at his desire, set about examining the original poems and the traditional stories of Fingal and his host, and got all within my reach who preserved in memory any part of either. This I found a work of some time and labour. With regard to the authenticity of the poems, they were, by the traditions of our forefathers, as far back as we can trace them, ascribed to Ossian, and to the most remote period of time of which we may have any account. It is a word commonly used in the Highlands to this day when they express a thing belonging to the most remote antiquity to call it Fiontach, that is, belonging to the time of Fingal. However much the several clans differ in the traditional history of their respective families, they are all agreed, as far as I could ever learn, with respect to the genuineness and authenticity of Ossian's poems. I am, sir, your most obedient, humble servant, Donald MacLeod.
Well, Eddie, you've discovered a tremendous amount about the house where you live in, but is there anything else you would like to know that we can perhaps help you with?
There's various things I'd like to know. One is I have seen other manses that look almost exactly like this one that were presumably built by the same people at the same sort of time. I would like to find out who designed these manses. Presumably someone was commissioned by the Church of Scotland to come up with an architectural design that could be adapted to local conditions and put up perhaps by local builders. I just don't know anything about that and how that worked and who that designer might have been. The other question which has always intrigued me is, you know, this is really quite a big house. And if you look back to when this house and even its predecessor were built, then everybody else in the glen is living in very small black houses and, you know, quite primitive accommodation. And I've been intrigued by, you know, the status that the minister has in parishes like this, you know, the relationship between the minister and his parishioners, how much he could call on his parishioners to be his domestic servants, to be his agricultural labourers and so on. Just how the class system worked, I'm intrigued by that. Really all the things that I've discovered about the house I've discovered accidentally, because somebody's come knocking on the door and said my great-grandfather used to live here, or somebody said, oh, there's a book which mentions your house. But I don't really know anything about the sources where you find out about what the minister's business was at a particular time, how the land was transferred, you know, how it all worked with land ownership, with the ownership of the glebe, who owned what. I don't know these things. Where do you find all that out?
Well, Eddie Stephen of Glen Elg there posing some excellent questions. How were manses designed and why are so many the same shape and size? And why did ministers of the Kirk have such grand properties to live in? There are two fabulous sources for anything to do with the Church of Scotland. The first is the Fasti Ecclesiae Scoticanae, which is just Latin for the list of the Church of Scotland ministers. We call it the Fasti in the trade, and you can find these in local libraries and on the internet. I looked up the Synod of Glen Elg, of which Glen Elg Parish was the seat, and indeed I found Donald MacLeod, minister there from 1756 until his death in 1781, and a reference to his letter of 1764 to Dr. Blair on the Ossian controversy. I also found Alexander Beath, presented by Charles Grant of Glen Elg in 1830 and translated, as they say, to Stirling in 1839. The other good source for parish information is the Statistical Accounts of Scotland, which were written by parish ministers. The second, or new statistical account, was compiled in the 1830s and 1840s, and indeed the entry for Glen Elg is written by the Reverend Beath in 1836. He says,
"The present manse of Glen Elg was built 4 years ago. Of considerable extent and handsome structure, from the commanding situation in which it stands and in full view of the sea, it forms a striking object in connection with the surrounding exquisite scenery. The glebe is of great extent, being above 360 acres, 50 of which nearly are good arable, the remainder being pasture."
Alexander Beath goes on to describe how, after the 1715 Jacobite Rebellion, MacLeod of Glen Elg sold the land on which the old parish man stood, so that a barracks could be built at Bernera to guard the strategic ferry crossing to Skye at the Kyle Rea Narrows. Another manse was erected with glebe, which added nicely to the incumbent stipend of, get this, £273, 7 shillings and 9 pence halfpenny a year. The 1830s manse itself came later, and at an interesting time. There had been two Acts of Parliament in 1823 and 1824, and the church commissioners published plans for kirks big enough to accommodate 312 souls and manses, and parishes could send away for these. The great builder, Thomas Telford, was involved. Now, we remember him mainly for railway projects, bridges, aqueducts and so on, but between 1823 and 1830, he supervised the design and building of churches and manses. Telford died in 1834, but we know from the Reverend Beath that the Glen Elg manse was erected about 1832, so it's entirely possible that this is a building at least influenced by Telford. There are two other manses in neighbouring parishes of roughly the same design, one in Letterfern on Loch Duich and one in Caillechan. And why the size? Well, it was church law that manses had to have so many public rooms, drawing room, sitting room, dining room, a study for the minister's quiet contemplations, and at least one spare bedroom for visiting ministers assisting in the conduct of worship. Also, ministers were expected to be fruitful and multiply and would need to accommodate nursemaids, domestic servants and the like. The 1841 census shows the next minister at Glen Elg, John McCrae, living there with his wife, four children, a sister-in-law, a governess, five female and four male servants. Much the same in 1851. In fact, the servants were accommodated in a slightly separate building to the side. The Reverend Beath's story had an unhappy ending, though. The cholera epidemic that swept the Highlands in the early 1830s took four of his children in 6 weeks. They're buried in the local churchyard, and their tragedy is told in the minister's own published diary, Sorrowing Yet Rejoicing, and in a novel written by his great-great-granddaughter, Janet Beath, called No Second Spring. Now, has your home had an interesting previous use? Get in touch and tell us. Some of you already have, by emailing ahousewiththepast@bbc.co.uk or by writing the old-fashioned way to BBC Breechgrove Terrace, Aberdeen, AB15 5ZT. As Marie Curry did.
My husband and I bought our property in Twynham, Kirkcudbright in 1989 when it was advertised as being 17th century. Elderly locals told us it used to be the local inn for farmers returning from the market at Castle Douglas. They would drink too much, hop on the cart and the horses took them home. I also believe it was a small dairy run by two sisters. An old outbuilding did resemble a wash place, now our garage. Thanks for any info.
The trick here would be to find out what the place was originally called. To do that, get your title deeds if you have them, or call Registers of Scotland and ask for a search as far back as possible. Get the earliest saisons, that's property transfers, and that will give you something to go on. The link to Registers of Scotland is on our webpage, www.bbc.co.uk/Radio Scotland, and go to A House with a Past. And there you'll find photos of this next house I visited. Now, I was brought up on the East Coast by the sea, though not in a holiday resort, but our next port of call certainly qualifies. Muriel Armstrong lives in St Abbs Haven in the Scottish Borders. It has a great view of Coldingham Sands and down the rocky coastline to Eyemouth. Now, the building isn't particularly old, only 100 years or so, but has had some interesting uses over the years, including being an orphanage and a hotel. Muriel has the original front door and porch of the building. And I met her there on a lovely sunny day at this perfect holiday spot. Her association with St Abbs goes back long before she actually lived here.
Well, yes, it's my husband, really, who came initially. He came in the late 40s when he was about 10. And at that time, they slept in the bedroom just above here, which is our main bedroom. And eventually, when we had three children, we were given this room because it was a large room, which is now our sitting room.
I just love this. You like the hotel bedroom so much that you buy it.
That's it. Well, the story is that we came up in October with our two small grandchildren. We came to take them for a trip on the beach and we promised them lunch in the hotel. And having climbed up from the beach, we found when we got here, there was no more hotel, but there was a developer creating six houses and one flat. So family story now goes that instead of buying lunch, we bought a house. You can actually see it as you come up from Eyemouth. And of course, in the days when my husband first came and also when we brought the children, it was the first one to see the haven, got an ice cream. Everybody got excited as they got nearer. And it does stand out with its red roof and its white facade.
Muriel, it's wonderful that a gorgeous place like this is still being loved and appreciated, and you've managed to collect so much information about it.
Within the porch, there is a plaque there of the people who originally built the house.
Let's go and see that. It sounds very interesting. Oh, this is fabulous. Yes, actually, the name's painted onto the plaster. It says, "Let us gratefully remember all those who helped to make this house, 1905-1906. And the first name on it is R. Dixon, aged 84. Yes, you just wonder exactly how much work he did on the house. And A. Dixon cut the first sod, 1st April 1905.
Well, it was initially built for a Miss Jane Hay, who was a lady from Leith. She did a lot of work for the lifeboat, and she witnessed the big tragedy they had here, the Alfred Eslander, where 17 people were lost. And she was so appalled by this that she put pressure on the authorities to raise money. She initiated the first lifeboat. She took in orphans, the most notable of which was a babe in arms, in fact, whose father had died in the Titanic.
What happened to the orphanage after she died? Who took it over then?
Well, it didn't remain an orphanage. It became like a guest house. A lady from the village, Isabel Cow.
Is that Isabel Cow, the famous suffragette?
That's right. I believe she made quite a name for herself. I'd like to know a little bit more about what she got up to.
In front of us here, I can see some lovely leather-bound old books. One says Our Guests, another one says Visitor's Book. This was loaned to you by St Abbs Museum, I believe. Oh, there are two or three visitor's books. What do we have here?
This is the one during the war, and I've marked here where we've got a little note in the margin. Fourth visit this year. Nuff said. Happy, I will return.
And look here, someone's written, 20th visit, more to come, we hope. And, oh, I can see someone's actually inscribed a poem. That's rather 1944.
In this blessed spot I soon forgot the dreaded siren's railing sound, for far from London's dim and raw, this wondrous haven I have found. Yes.
And they go on to say that if you take the word heaven and put an extra E in it, I'd call it heaven.
By the sea.
By the sea. Lily A. David. Absolutely fabulous.
Every week they seem to be raising money for either the lifeboat or the Royal Infirmary in Edinburgh in those days, and for children's charities.
This is rather interesting, this one here. What does this say? Receipts for various things. Golf, putting, ankle competition. What on earth is an ankle competition?
Isn't that wonderful? The most glamorous ankle, I suppose. But it's traditions, I think, probably started with Isabel Cow, the singing of grace. The gong would go and everybody trooped in for lunch and supper. If you were late, you weren't allowed in during grace, and then the lifeboat box was placed in front of you, and it was expected that you put something in if you turned up late for meals. Mm-hmm. She apparently had the tradition whereby all the guests had to kiss her when they arrived, so this was another little quirk. She never married, and as I say, she died while she owned the property here.
There seems to be a thread running through here of strong women and good works.
Definitely, yes, with those two, yes.
So I have to ask you, you've done quite a lot of research yourself, but is there anything you would like to find out about the building?
There was a door through there into the main lounge, which was the main feature of the hotel. And it had a gallery going round with a magnificent staircase going up.
Like a minstrel's gallery, you mean?
A minstrel's gallery, that's right. And that's where the picture of St Ebba was placed.
St Ebba, that would be the same as St Abb that the village is named after?
Yes, she was the abbess at the abbey up at St Abb's Head. And this was about 667, that sort of time.
So the early days of the Christian Church, yes.
Mm. Yeah, very much. She was very much associated with Cuthbert and with Bede. Mm. And she features in their writing. It was a full-length picture of her. Sadly, the haven stood open between buyers, I think, and it was cut out of a frame, unfortunately. And it's rather sad that that's went missing. And this is why they say that St Ebba comes looking for her picture. Apparently, there has been an instance just recently where the lady who was sleeping in the area which was originally the lounge woke up with a hand on her face, so who knows?
Well, this is maybe one where our listeners can do a bit of detective work, and if anyone out there has ever seen this or knows where it might be, they could get in touch with us and we'll see if it'd be possible to restore it to its natural place and maybe give the poor woman a bit of rest after 1,400 years or so.
So, can anyone help with more information on the suffragette Isabel Cow? And do get in touch if you have any knowledge of the St. Ebba picture and its whereabouts. Muriel would love to know, and she can tell the old abbess when she sees her. Now, if you're just starting out as a property detective, or if you have any niggling questions about your home, your local library is a great place to start looking for answers. I recently visited my home county of Fife, specifically the county town Cooper. I met Sheila Campbell, local studies and family history librarian, in the rather splendid 1870s Scottish baronial-style library. I asked her about the most popular house research resources on offer.
Probably the most frequently used ones for house histories would be the census returns from 1841 to 1901. Census returns are very valuable in gauging how large a property was, because in most of the census returns, apart from the early ones, it'll have a column at the end that says rooms with more than one window, so you can actually ascertain how large the house was or how small it was. Also, they'll give the household, so you can find out if they had servants or not, so you can tell what kind of standing they had in the community. And of course, most important, it would give the occupation. Valuation rolls, they're also helpful, plus the trade street directories for larger boroughs and towns, and probably for cities as well. Electoral registers can also be useful if you've built up a picture of who was living in the house over a period of time.
And you may well have newspapers and newspaper indexes available too.
Yes, you will find that a lot of the local newspapers have been indexed, and they'll either be in maybe a card form or microfiche form, or some have actually been put onto computer as well. It's also worth mentioning that newspapers themselves would have adverts for property that was for sale. So if you've an idea of when the house or property was sold, you could perhaps look at the newspaper for that period or date and see the actual advert, just as nowadays people advertise their property for sale in the local press.
Some of the records you mentioned, like electoral registers and valuation rolls and so on, these are all held at the National Archives in Edinburgh. But you're telling me that copies exist in local libraries too?
Yes, most local libraries will have copies of valuation rolls. We won't have the same coverage that the National Archives have, and there may be some volumes that are missing, that have gone missing over the years, or they just were never kept. But it's worth going into your local library and finding out what we have on a particular place, whether it's a town, a village, or even a rural part of the county. Something you really shouldn't overlook is the local books in local libraries, local collections. For instance, some of the guidebooks or guided walk books are quite interesting to look at, and you may actually find something on a house that's in a high street or a main street.
But you know, Sheila, it's sometimes hard to visualise exactly where a house is just from a street number. Any way a local library can help you with that one?
Probably a map might help you. I've got one here from 1824, which is John Wood's town plans. He did a series of them all over Scotland in the early 1800s, and this is the one for Kirkcaldy. Interestingly enough, it gives the names of the people who actually were residing in the properties. So very useful, because it's obviously before census returns and valuation rolls.
And the John Wood series, as you say, they're from the 1820s. They're fabulously detailed and they're very readily accessible. You can buy them for about £5 off the internet.
You can also access them on the National Library of Scotland's website. They have digitised some of the Wood plans, and obviously you can come into your local library and get free internet access.
Sheila Campbell of Cooper Library in Fife. Use your local library. You'll be amazed at what they have. Now, back to some letters we've received at BBC Beechgrove Terrace, Aberdeen. Remember, you can also email us at ahousewiththepast@bbc.co.uk. We've had lots of queries relating to former schools, including this from Margaret and David Finn.
Our house, Schoolhouse Polnacki in Castle Douglas, was built with a school in 1803, and we've always been interested in finding out about the previous occupants. We were the first occupants who were not connected to the school, as the house had previously been let to the head teacher of the school.
Yes, interesting place, Palnaki. It used to be the port for Castle Douglas, and it has some rather fine 19th century houses built of local granite, including Burlochan House, a true Scottish baronial mansion. But here's the answer. Look at the censuses from 1841 to 1901. You can see them yourself at scotlandspeople.gov.uk or ask at your local library. If you want to find birth, marriage and death information on the occupants, again, use Scotland's People or visit your local registrar's office. They can do lookups for a fee. Remember to look for the registration district of Balmagee and the civil parish of Buttle. In 1891, the schoolhouse at Palnaki was occupied by William Caird, the teacher, and his wife Mary, and various children. The 1884 valuation roll gives Caird as the occupant, and the post office directory for 1921 shows Samuel McKee as the schoolmaster. You can look all that up in your local library. Now, staying on the subject of schools, Claire Ruthven writes,
I live in a small village called Maxton in the Scottish Borders. Growing up in the area, I'm a local history enthusiast and would like to know more about my cottage that I rent from the Duke of Sutherland. Apparently, it was once two cottages, and the room which I use as a lounge was the old school almost 200 years ago. It would just be fantastic to find old articles and pictures from this time.
Maxton was in Roxburghshire, another disappeared county. In 1851 and later, William Chisholm from Melrose was the dominie in the parochial school. He had six children, and the 1861 census shows the schoolhouse to have six rooms. I'd see if the Scottish Borders Archives Hub has any photos. And here's a general tip for anyone researching the Scottish Borders. The Heritage Hub is a fabulous new facility in Hawick. Details on our webpage. Now, in general, schools will be run by the local school board. The Education Act of 1696 set up elementary education in every parish. It wasn't necessarily free, but supported by a tax on landowners and country districts, the heritors, and municipal funds in boroughs, with the Kirk Sessions and charity paying the fees of the poorest. Details will be in Kirk Session records. From 1872, borough and parish schools came under school boards, and those records are usually in the county archives. Well, that's it for today, but we do want to hear from you. Have you discovered something unusual in your home? Did you have a famous occupant? Or any examples of unusual places to stay? If you have a query about the history of your house or an interesting story to share, please email us at ahousewithapast@bbc.co.uk or write to us at BBC Beechgrove Terrace, Aberdeen, AB15 5ZT. Meanwhile, from me, Bruce Durie, and the team, goodbye.